Morning.
I'd like to welcome you all to the second in our series of living differences. Our series of the world of peace and justice, put together these programs we appreciate. I'm going to remind you that next week, July 24th, will be the third in our series, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in Our Schools with Dr. Charles Herring. We will be doing Zoom, so we will have Zoom as well. We will have online, but we will also have it here in the chat for that series. So, before we begin, I'd like to open the word. Please join. Dear God, thank you for the opportunities you give us to understand vulnerability, to understand differences and similarities, and to create a fresh understanding of the refugees and those in need. Thank you for the teachers who come to programs like this to help guide us, to help inform us, to help give us a new perspective and a new way of thinking about our country. We pray for all those refugees and refugee families who have found
themselves in the midst of conflict, strife, turmoil, war, and famine. We ask that you can help guide them to safer places and help them find comfort and ease. We thank you also for those you call to help refugees and immigrants and anyone who finds themselves homeless and hopeless. Help us to share the hope that you give us each day and to provide for the needs for all of your children. Amen. All right, it is my pleasure this morning to introduce Dr. Azadi Masaladin Block, Azzy as she likes to be called. And Azzy is an associate professor and the department chair of health and human services professions at Penn West University, California. Now that's the part I had to really work on. Yeah. She is a native of Western Pennsylvania, born in Newcastle, and resides here in Pittsburgh. Dr. Block has extensive experience in psychiatric and social service programs and research and administration. She has worked in a variety of treatment programs, including structural family therapy at both New England Medical Center and Western Psych. Dr. Block has presented her research at international venues, such as the Council on Social Work Education, an International Association of Social Work with Groups, as well as the local levels of the National Association of Social Worker chapter conferences. Additionally, she is an alumnus of the Albert Schweitzer Fellowship Program. Dr. Block previously taught at Youngstown State University, the University of Pittsburgh, of which she's an alumni, and Slippery Rock University. Her research interests include cultural humility, refugee and immigrant services, and social work with families and groups. And her current research is with the Jewish Family and Community Services of Pittsburgh and focusing on program evaluation for their peer support groups for the resettlement of refugees and newer immigrants to southwestern Pennsylvania. So very timely for our congregation. So Azzy, Dr. Block, take it away. Thank you.
Longer. Yes. Okay. We're good at things like that. Okay. So hi, everybody. Welcome. Pleasure to be here. I want to say that I have a lot of slides, and I know I'm not going to get through all of these slides because a lot of them are about specific immigrant and refugee groups, but I wanted you all to have a lot of information because I know you don't know now what country, ethnicity, religion, the family is that you'll all be supporting. So I wanted to give you as many facts about those populations as they've been resettled to southwestern PA. And I thought I'd take a little bit of time to talk about maybe a couple of the groups that I think you're most likely to resettle. For example, individuals from Afghanistan or individuals from Syria, which might be more likely for you. And if you end up with a family from Ukraine, I think in many ways that the cultural barriers that are there are going to be less than the ones you might face with a family from Afghanistan or Syria. So I'll talk a little bit about those groups, and I'll talk a little bit about what cultural humility has meant to me. And I'm hoping we'll get time to do a little bit of an exercise. If we don't, I can at least show you my example of the exercise so that maybe you could do it on your own as you think about this process of what cultural humility is. So I like to start off all my talks with goals, because goals are good, right? So the goals of this presentation, which I think is now behind me, to be able to define what cultural humility really means, to gain knowledge about some of the refugee and immigrant populations that are being resettled to Allegheny County, and to increase knowledge of how to integrate that cultural humility into the work with a resettled family that you all work with and connect with. So it's kind of broken up into two parts. In this first part, I don't want to, again, like I want to have time, and I really realize it's 9:50 and I'm feeling like frenzied on time. So I want to make sure that we get to some good stuff. But I sort of want to give a context for resettlement to this area by talking just a brief bit about the history of, you know, where we are all standing and thinking about all the layers of immigration that have happened to this place. So sort of more broadly to talk about why people immigrate. So I think just as you start thinking about this from the perspective of cultural humility, think about why your relatives came here, right? What was the reason? What was the push, or what was the pull that brought them here? So when I think about my own family, for example, my grandmother's family came here from Slovenia. So they came from the cities of Idria and Sirkica, and they came here at separate times and met in Johnstown and married there. But they came here for opportunity. You know, Eastern Europe was facing a lot of issues in terms of famine. There was not opportunity for work. And so a lot of people were immigrating to the United States. So that they came here for that reason. My grandfather's side of the family, the Gears, came here like, go back all the way to the Mayflower. So those were folks who were like, kind of like, again, like it was religious persecution that brought them to the United States. So very different reasons, even within my own family. And then clearly Azadeh Mesaladon, not a Slovenian name, it's Persian. My dad came here from Iran for college. So he was the first in his family to leave Iran and come here, and he went straight to California. He went to Whittier College. So just thinking about the different things, right? So he came here for an opportunity for education, he was the oldest boy in his family, the oldest of eight, came here to better that family. So for your own family, starting to think about why folks came here. And I think as you understand that push and pull of why people come, it will help you to better understand a family and what's brought them here. And how a really important thing that I've been talking a lot about to JFCS, actually, as these circles are happening, as families are helping to be resettled, is the notion of the family we envision we're getting and the family we actually get. Because I think a lot of times something that's happening for folks is they're envisioning a family who's going to be like excited to be here or excited about new opportunities. And for some folks, they're very traumatized. They have a lot of sadness about having to leave their home and the push that took them from that place and brought them here. And while some part of them is certainly grateful that they're alive or that they're going to be given a chance to thrive again, some part of them is also mourning the life they left behind. And again, probably some of you can think about your own relatives, you know, your grandparents or your parents who maybe had a similar experience, who had a hard time with integrating to the United States. So I think those are things I really want you to start reflecting on as you're thinking about this family that you're going to be helping, because that's what we're seeing time and time again, is that there are so many folks who want to help others and want to use resources that they have to help other families who are coming here. But then the experience of working with them isn't exactly what they imagined it to be. And I think it's good to be prepared that there could be some folks who are really insular and a little depressed, and you know, you have to give them time to kind of open up to you. So sort of that piece of this war and conflict, the economic insecurity that a lot of folks face when they're in their home country, they're not able to really make a living for their family, provide for their family as they once had been able to. I mean, we've seen how inflation has even affected that here in the United States during this very brief period of time. Imagine the inflation that's happening in some countries right now, like Syria, Iraq. The inflation there is just skyrocketing. Folks can't really afford to buy basic things for their families. Sri Lanka, if you've heard any of the things happening in Sri Lanka right now. So just those sort of layers of things. And then, of course, environmental disaster. We're seeing how the warming of our climate is really affecting, you know, we're seeing more landslides, we're seeing rain that's devastating individuals in areas where homes are not built like they're built in the United States. So we're seeing a lot of folks who are also being pushed and pulled because of the climate changing. Okay, so again, right, this idea between involuntary migration, being, you know, brought here through slavery, through other means, there is still human trafficking that happens. I have a very dear friend who works in New York City in the office that deals with individuals who've been trafficked. And so human trafficking, while it seems, you know, maybe it seems something like we wouldn't experience here in Pittsburgh so much, there is trafficking that goes on in Western Pennsylvania. And a lot of it at some point in time here was related to the oil and gas industry, very unfortunately. So we have to think about that there are contexts too that even bring people here. You know, I think that's highly unlikely to be the family that you're encountering, but there are stories like this that are present day stories. A lot of that is beyond the migrants' control. And, you know, historically just thinking about colonization as a part of that too, and thinking about how England and sort of its relationship to so many of these countries and sort of what language folks will speak when they arrive here too is very intricately connected to colonial relationships that at one time existed. Another huge problem here is that we don't really have comprehensive immigration policy. We haven't really had any since 1970. So a lot of what's happened has been very haphazard. Interestingly, I think a lot of folks don't know what's happening for Ukrainian individuals being resettled here, but they're not being given a pathway to citizenship. Any of them. They're being given 2 years here to work and to live, and then they're being expected to return to Ukraine. So that's, I mean, if you think about it, right, if you know that now, you're a Ukrainian family, many might not necessarily come here. They may come here if they have a chain, they have a family member here, they have a relative here. Maybe that's worth it to come here or live with them. You know, the expense of all of that would be worth it to them. But for other individuals who would have nothing connecting them here, to live here only 2 years and to have to return might not make the most sense. So some families might be preferring to stay in Europe or to go to Canada, where there are pathways to citizenship. But, you know, because things are so polarized in the United States, we can't come up with comprehensive immigration reform and make it a way for folks from Ukraine who, you know, really need a place to be resettled to. They need some stability, as we're all seeing when we see things that are happening in the news. So that's really hard part too. And you know, what's hard for folks like myself who are social workers, we see that there are such labor shortages right now, and we're not doing enough to really support our own economy through immigration. And that's really frustrating. I think one of the places where some of you may be seeing this, you know, not only like, Target or Giant Eagle or like, you know, like let's call those lower skilled jobs, but high skilled jobs, nursing jobs, a lot of jobs in healthcare right now, we do not have enough employees in these locations to support the needs of our healthcare system. So there's a lot of ways in which comprehensive immigration reform would really benefit everybody. I just thought I'd throw some interesting statistics in here because I find some of this stuff very fascinating. So this statistic, how about that? Oh, next one, the one that has the big, yeah. No, even the next one after that, that says migration in Pennsylvania. Yes, look at that one. So 74% of Pennsylvanians are born in Pennsylvania compared to Florida, where it's 36%. So let me just ask you, I guess this is like, I'm going to ask the audience and now Zoom people, watch out for you if you can't hear somebody. What does that mean to all of you? 74% of people who are Pennsylvanian were born here. What do you think that means about our population in Pennsylvania?
I'll say something that might make you laugh, but I think there's a lot of Allegheny County families where the kids grow up, might move away, and then they come back home. I mean, I'm one of them. You could say I was born in Allegheny County and I'll die here.
Sure. Yeah, that's very true. There's a lot of that boomeranging occurring. Yes. Uh-huh. But definitely. What else does it tell you about opportunity here or other stuff like that?
It seems like we, given the statistic, we don't have a lot of experience in welcoming people. We expect that you're not new.
Yes, there is a lot of this new individuals is a more rare circumstance, I suppose. And I think it's interesting. I mean, you're in the South Hills here, so you've encountered some of the Bhutanese refugees, ethnically Nepali folk who are now resettled in this area. But that took a while for those folks to really establish themselves, kind of set up a community. But in general, you know, what we see in Pennsylvania is because there hasn't really been a strong job market here, there isn't a lot pulling people here. What pulled people here for the Bhutanese especially was that this is where they resettled because JFCS put a lot of money into resettling a number of families here, and it kind of chain affected other families coming here. They were like, oh, we know a family in Pittsburgh. Oh, we know a family in Pittsburgh. And so that family kind of built up, and they kind of figured out a lot of them are involved in real estate in the South Hills, if some of you are aware of that. But it's really cool what they've done and the niche they've found. And especially because of the real estate market here kind of blowing up so much in the last 10 years, it's been very helpful to them in terms of establishing a strong market. Yeah.
Would it be reasonable to think that maybe we did all our immigration in the 19th and early 20th century and kind of shut the door after that?
Well, I mean, it's a great point because it's when we had a burgeoning steel industry and other things supporting that, right? Or things up in Newcastle, like Shenango, China. There were a lot of different, you know, factory sort of jobs all throughout the region. And a lot of that just kind of crushed and fell. And I think I have a few slides to talk about that. This one, oh, the next one. Oh no, slides. We have to coordinate ourselves. A couple of my slides, and just let me preview myself here. I think I have one that talks all about the Western PA. Yeah, so the next couple talk about like PA roots, right? A lot of things that you already know. For example, we all know the history of, well, maybe you don't all know the history. I shouldn't presume that. Some of us know the history of indigenous peoples in this area, but you know, up behind me, the Western PA roots, we've got the Lenape, the Delaware, the Susquehannocks, the Iroquois, the Shawnee, and other groups that a lot of the historical data shows them being here up to 15,000 years ago. So when we talk about, you know, the groups that have been here a long time, I think a lot of times we kind of erase those first indigenous groups. So I want to just kind of acknowledge that, especially in this presentation, as we, you know, for so many of us in this room, especially, we're connecting our roots to people who came here from Western and Eastern European places. After that, we had settlers from Sweden, Holland, England. But by the 1700s, people who had once been enslaved, Black persons were moving here from the South. And we had a lot of immigrants coming in from Ireland too. And I spent a little time in Ireland. So I always refer to that as the Great Hunger rather than the famine, because folks who are of Irish in origin will often talk about how there was food in Ireland. It just had to go back to the lords in England. And it wasn't that there was a lack of food. It was that they were not allowed to have that food. And that food pushed them out. So they call it the Great Hunger in Ireland, which I think is another important contextual piece. Because again, it's always about who wrote history, right? So what angle did that come from? Great famine, great hunger, same experience. And as we were just discussing, the industrialization that happened here, you know, some of the titans of the time, Carnegie, Frick, others, you know, we had a lot of economic refugees come here and work in those industries. So I had coal miners in my family, you know, I'm sure many of you did, if your family goes back that far, and that grow, you know, that supported that growing steel industry. But when it collapsed hard. And I think I wasn't really aware of these statistics until I sat down at, I think when Marta and I were working on the City of Pittsburgh training to think about the actual numbers of folks, but about 289,000 families left Pittsburgh in the 1990s, which is huge. I mean, you think about how big this city was and what it is now. And I think right now we're not losing population in the city of Pittsburgh any longer. And there are some suburban areas that are finally growing, but it took a long time to stabilize. I mean, it's, you know, 2022, right? So that's a very long time. So I think we talked about this a little bit. So these are just some of the questions as you're thinking about this family that you're resettling, as you're thinking about yourself and what cultural humility means to you. You know, when did your family come here? What pushed or pulled them? And how might a recent immigrant story be similar to one of your own family history? And also then, of course, how might it be different? So let me take a couple minutes now to talk about a couple of the populations I think you're most likely to see If anybody has other questions about other groups that are in this presentation, happy to, you just raise your hand and I'm happy to talk more about what I know about those populations, especially through my work with JFCS on the peer support groups. So I'll mention that too, because probably some of you don't know about that. But one of the things JFCS has done that's been hugely successful is they've created peer support groups. So an individual, usually they identify a few individuals who are sort of pillars of the community. Those folks will help to run these groups and they help to resettle other folks through like a peer network, kind of similar to the circle you're about to have to help resettle this family. But it's a circle of folks who are teaching other people how to navigate the bus system, how to learn about like where to go grocery shopping, how to use the, you know, a lot of them have benefits for the first few months they're here, how to make those benefits stretch as far as they can to support their family. So it's sort of an informal network that has been hugely successful in that isolation piece that so many new refugees and immigrants experience in lessening that impact. It's been shown to be very successful in addressing those issues of social isolation. So this next slide just kind of shows you all the different, you know, the mixture of current, old groups of individuals who are resettling to this area. So obviously, if I talk about all of them, we won't even have time to really get through all of that. So I'm going to kind of jump around and I want to talk about, especially the Bhutanese, because I think probably many of you have encountered some ethnically Nepali or Bhutanese folks since you're in the South Hills. And then I thought I'd talk about Syrian refugees and Afghani refugees. So, you know, a little, and I'm actually, in honesty, while I don't think this will be the family you resettle, there has been a lot more, many more families coming that are identified as Latine. And I think this is another interesting like language thing that's come up a lot. What do we call folks who are coming from Central America, South America, Mexico, right? I mean, there's like, especially in our region, I think a lot of people call folks Hispanic. And I think it's like one of these things, like, what do we do? And I'll say this in reality, in general, most folks like to be referred to from the country that they're from, right? Like I am Mexican, I am Honduran, yeah. But if you can't figure it out, most individuals don't really go by Hispanic and they don't go by Latinx, which is one of those things that I think a lot of us have read probably in a newspaper or some, you know, we've seen it. Latinx is actually not, it doesn't work in the Spanish language. You usually have to have a vowel before the X, and the X is not really an X sound in Spanish. It's a tick sound. So it's very hard for Spanish speaking individuals to say Latinx. So I think there was a survey done like in the Washington Post or something. And for individuals who are Spanish speaking, 3% of them use the term Latinx. Many of them prefer actually the term Latine because it allows them to be inclusive of all gender. And it doesn't make them have to switch between a masculine and a feminine all the time, which is not something that happens in Spanish as much as it happens in other languages. So if you're ever trying to come up with like a broad term to use, the best one actually is Latine. So with the E there, the third option. Okay, so that's just, I think, an interesting point that's helpful for folks. Okay, so clearly geographically diverse, many are multilingual. But again, with your family that you experience, now it's gonna depend. Many of the special immigrant visa holders or individuals who helped the US government on, you know, its missions in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. I hope that wasn't my phone. Those individuals, usually one person is English speaking proficiently. And that will also then typically be the person who's working outside of the home and may not be the person that you really interact with at all, because it might be the mom or grandparent or somebody else who you're interacting with. It's okay, don't worry. So that's important to think about too, that language proficiency might be something that's difficult. And so, you know, sometimes one of those things that will happen is talking to children instead of talking to parents. And it's really something to be mindful of, because in some cultures, it might be considered really, really disrespectful to kind of talk to kids before you talk to adults. So it's going to be one of those things that, you know, dependent on your own, the family that you all work with, you'll have to kind of negotiate and navigate how to interact linguistically. So just something to be mindful of. And if interpretation is needed, to think about that too, that one of the really important things about interpretation that most interpreters don't tell you is that you want to kind of pretend the interpreter is not even there. And you just talk directly to that individual, and that interpreter just acts as a conduit to share the conversation. But your focus should really just always be on that other person rather than, can you tell them this? Can you tell them that? Because it turns into a conversation with the interpreter, which is not actually the role that they're trained to do. The role they're trained to do is just to really literally translate your words. And again, another fact that I think is fun with that, 70% of our communication is nonverbal. So you'll be able to, like, you know, you pantomime things a little bit, you sort of expressively use your body, you know, people understand what you're saying, even if they can't exactly understand your words. So make sure that when you communicate that that communication is direct with the person that you're speaking to. So I have a dear friend who I've worked with for a number of years through the through JFCS, who is an individual who's ethnically Nepali, but came here through Bhutan, from Bhutan into Nepal. And it's a complicated history, but the brief of it is that they were all kind of, many of them ethnically were a minority. They were expelled from Nepal a long time ago, like 50 or 60 years ago, and pushed into Bhutan. Many of them were farmers. They did well in Bhutan. They had land. And then when a new king came into power, it pushed them out again. And they were literally pushed out in the middle of the night. And this was around the year 1985, pushed out. And for 20, these folks, my friend who talked about his story, he was like running through the jungle, like in the middle of the night. This is how like abrupt their departure was from Bhutan. And when they arrived in Nepal, they were immediately put into refugee camps where, you know, I think many of them thought they would be a brief period of time. They ended up living in those refugee camps for on average 20 years. And they were not allowed, the Nepali government would not allow them to leave the refugee camp. So they were stuck in that refugee camp. They could not leave to make a living. They could not leave for education. So the only individuals who really got education were the children who were educated by, you know, elders in the community within the camp. If you wanted to make any money, you had to sneak out and sneak back in, which could be very dangerous. You know, a lot of them talk about this, but they don't want to make a big deal about it. But they didn't have fresh fruits and vegetables, everything. They didn't have much protein to eat. Everything they ate was canned, basically. They ate canned foods for 20 years. And they talk a lot about how, if you've ever, I mean, maybe that's your regular diet, but for most people, we do eat some fresh things. And if for 20 years, all you're eating is canned things, that does kind of do a number on your body. And a lot of folks arrived here with a lot of different medical issues as a result of their malnutrition. So, you know, it's kind of like compounds the, like, here's our trauma, then here's our trauma of being in this place. Now here's our trauma of coming here. You know, it's like layers of trauma. They sometimes call it triple trauma when somebody is resettled to a new country. So just a little bit about their story. Many of them who arrive here older than 40 are not English proficient. And if any of you have tried to learn a new language when you're older, it's not an easy feat because our brain becomes static in a lot of ways with the language areas. Some folks are keen to be able to do it. You know, we all have that friend who's really good at languages. We all kind of hate, you know, because they're so good at it. But for a lot of us, it's very hard to learn a new language. So really the children and the younger ones are the ones who came here being able to learn English and are proficient. So it's also created a complexity for those individuals who have been resettled who will not gain English. And again, that's something to reflect on in your own families. There may have been a grandparent of your own who never really learned to speak English, or, you know, just thinking about the isolation that comes along with not having the language of the place in which you're living. So these are just some of the photos. The next one, the it's a little before. It's okay. You know what? It was just a picture of some of the refugee camp life. It's okay. We'll keep going. Because we're already at 10:15, this is what happens. Yeah, that's the slide, yeah. So that's some of like what the camps looked like for individuals who were in Eastern Nepal. No running water. I mean, they had the kerosene stoves. You know, they had like one stove in the space. And I mean, that's honestly the experience of a lot of folks who are in a refugee camp. They're in a shanty sort of situation like that. And it's everybody in one room and they don't have running water. And they have, if they're lucky, they have a kerosene stove to make their own meals on. Okay. And if we go down a bit, it has a little bit of stuff. So we also have individuals from Somalia. We have people from DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, often, you know, referred to as Congolese individuals. And a lot of those, again, lived in refugee camps before coming here. Usually not as long as the folks from Nepal. I think on average, it's like 7 to 10 years. But those experiences, again, it's that same kind of like level of triple trauma. And I would say that 7 to 10 years is still a very long time to be in a refugee, to be in an encampment sort of situation like that. So DRC, let me go to the, so the Syrians. So a lot of individuals from Syria, it depends. There is more English proficiency in the Syrian population than there is in the Afghani population, generally speaking, of husband-wife pairings. And a lot of the individuals, you know, since that's the Syrian civil war, which began in 2011, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and over 12 million people displaced. So I guess about 5.6 million of those were, you know, seeking shelter in surrounding countries. They were not necessarily trying to be resettled to the United States, but a lot of people were in extreme poverty and were in really difficult circumstances. So a lot of the folks who are Syrian refugees in Pittsburgh, many are Muslim. Again, and that can be a thing that separates folks on the face of things, right? The religious piece. And I suppose, you know, as a social worker, not really as a historian of religion, though I know a little bit about a lot of religions, I'm actually a Unitarian. So, you know, the Unitarians are kind of a non, what do we want to call them? They're like a history of the all peoples, we're all super inclusive kind of religion, and you believe what you want to believe, we respect that. But they, a lot of what I learned in my church was about world religions. And I think, you know, at the core of it, the values are the same. And I think that's the part to relate back into, is that it's a core of like a belief in a power greater than oneself, a belief in a treatment of other people with kindness and dignity. You know, it's those kind of core values of a religion that can actually be the way to connect with others rather than to see it as the piece that separates them. Okay, and so a lot of folks living in West End, Carnegie, not so far from here, and eastern suburbs of the city of Pittsburgh. Now the Afghan group, the special immigrant visa holders, it's complicated. So a lot of SIVs were being resettled here kind of slowly, right? Before everything broke out a year ago when we pulled out of Afghanistan fully and things kind of went to chaos. So there are some folks who are here on these special immigrant visas, but then the other status a lot of folks have is something called a parolee, which is like the worst term ever because it sounds like you've done something wrong. It's terrible. Like, I don't know what they were thinking when they called it this, but the other status is called being a parolee. So, and those folks are here, again, there's a pathway, but it's longer than the special immigrant visa. And they have to kind of go through a different level of checks that have not yet been done for the people who are SIVs. So the SIV checks were done in Afghanistan. The parolees are still going under kind of that background process while they're here. So a lot of folks who are here, the special immigrant visa holders are ones who have already been resettled here. Many of them are the leaders in the community already. They're the ones who are helping in those peer groups. They're the ones who maybe have already established a business. A lot of them have pretty good, at least one family member has very good English proficiency because they were doing something for the US government in Afghanistan. And, you know, it's the highly skilled part is also complex. For those of you who don't know this, you know, if you come here as a doctor from another country, to become a doctor again here is insanely difficult. Not only do you have to go through all the board testing again, but you actually have to be a resident all over again. So you have to go through that like 4-year process of residency. And for individuals who are like 50 years old, to be a resident again is overwhelming to think of doing that. So many of them don't do it. I mean, you know, in my work with JFCS, I know a few doctors who work at Home Depot. And it's, I mean, it's very, I don't want to call it humbling. It's very, I don't know, demoralizing at first. I think they come to a different, you have to come to a different place of understanding something like that if you're going to survive. But I think the initial impact of arriving here and realizing that you can no longer have the high status you once had is a very demoralizing thing. So that's something to be thoughtful about too, as you know, you encounter this family. Are they experiencing something like that where the head of household has sort of experienced a career shift that they can no longer engage in the career that had, you know, given their life a lot of meaning? I mean, think about for all of us, what gives our life meaning? And if we were told you can't really do that anymore, you know, go work at Home Depot, it's hard. That's very hard. So just a little bit about some of the languages. The parolee status for some moving into Pittsburgh, you know, is that other piece that we just discussed. They don't qualify for public benefits when they're a parolee. They only qualify for it when they're a special immigrant visa. But a lot of organizations like yourself, so this could be an individual that you end up supporting, because a lot of them are ending up in a different situation because they can't get money through the federal government as a parolee. They have to get money through different means, like private parochial agencies. So sometimes who churches end up supporting is a parolee status individual. So good to know that term, I guess. And then a couple of the other slides are just talk about some of the groups that have been here for a little bit longer, Iraqi individuals, folks from Burundi, Indian, Chinese, Uzbek. The Chinese population in Pittsburgh, along with the Indian, is varied. People come here at all different times for all kinds of different reasons with all different levels of English proficiency. I'm sure living in Upper St. Clair, you know families who are Chinese, you know families who are Indian, and their reasons for coming here vary across the board. In the city of Pittsburgh, one of the things we've experienced with newer immigrants from China is that a lot of them are grandparents of current students. So they're graduate students and their parents have come here to help care for a child or children. And so those individuals are very socially isolated too, because they're older, they don't have English proficiency, and they're kind of alone with little kids all day long. So we've created some specific groups through JFCS to help support those older individuals who are Chinese, to kind of get them connected to others who are just like themselves, who are kind of isolated. And that's been a really positive experience in the city. So I think that's kind of all for my first part of things. Does anybody have any questions about the, oh, that just came up a little louder. Any questions about the groups we talked about? Anything, yeah.
I was involved with SHIM for a while, and with the Bhutanese coming over. How, on an education perspective, are the kids integrated into the schools, or are they kept within, culturally kept within their own community? And how the schools and things like that, trying to integrate them, responded to that?
Yeah, so the public schools have to provide ESL, English as a second language courses, to these students who arrive here without English proficiency. And I'd say that most individuals are engaging in their public schools. It's not until families are really established and have like the monetary resources to kind of choose some other like separate institution that they can do such a thing. So a lot of folks are engaging in the public school system, and they get those ESL courses, and that's a residency connected. So as soon as you're a resident and you have an address, you have to be given ESL classes. So the kids get English proficiency quickly. It is the adults who have to, you know, go to the library or get a Zoom class, or, right, there's kind of more hurdles for anybody over 18.
So they're not subject to that 2-year limit?
In terms of the...
You were talking about there's a 2-year limit on...
So for the, well, the Ukrainian families, their visa is going to be a 2-year limit. So at the end of 2 years, they'll have overstayed a visa, and then they'll like kind of be breaking the law. And so it's one of these things where, I mean, some individuals just leave and come back in, and come back in on tourist visas over and over again for 3-month periods. But after 2 years, anybody who's not on a pathway to citizenship would have to leave. But the school system doesn't report back such things. Do you know what I mean? Like they sort of let that be. They don't go, hey, you're over your 2-year limit and you need to, the schools don't enforce such things. Usually it's ICE or immigrant, you know, customs groups that would do that. And they usually only come after somebody if there's, and I think in the city of Pittsburgh, there's a specific thing that says ICE can't come. They have to talk to the Pittsburgh police about anything like that. So families are pretty buffered and safe in that regard.
I have a friend who taught the ESL classes. Ooh. And
yeah,
of course, the husband was brought here because he was a higher up in one of the industries.
Sure.
And you know, whatever, Bayer or Alcoa. Mm-hmm. But the wife, the mother, was not fluent in mm-hmm. English. And so often this friend would be hired to teach the mother English.
Oh, that's cool. That's great.
So that's what happens. You would just individually treat them.
That's great. Did the family have the resource to be able to do that? Like they had
apparently they did.
Yeah. That's wonderful that they were otherwise.
And then on another area, you mentioned, I thought you mentioned that we would not be having the same difficulty with understanding or talking with them or them speaking.
There aren't a lot of new Iraqi families being resettled to this area. A lot of the Iraqis who came here before even the war with Iraq. So they came here in like the 1970s and 80s. They didn't come here. Iraqi refugees didn't come to the United States after they sort of went regional. Like a lot of Syrian refugees. Most Syrian refugees are like, you know, in Jordan or somewhere else. They didn't come to the U.S. The Afghans are sort of a unique situation because of our quick pullout in this sort of Biden, if you want to call it Biden bleeding heart of sorts, where he's like, no, come on, we'll resettle you across the ocean and that'll be what's best for you. And I mean, I'm not sure that that's what's best for everybody if they're not going to be able to be English proficient to move so far culturally, regionally. You know, it's hard to know what's, every family has to figure out what's best for their situation. And I think some families are pulled here by other forces that it's not necessarily where they're going to thrive. So the next part of what I was going to do in this presentation, let's see how much time I have. Okay, like 15 minutes, which is good. Do we have paper and pencil? Do we have like things we can write on? All right, okay, we're going to do a little activity. What do you think of that? That's going to be fun. Everybody loves an activity. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what cultural humility is again, because I know Marta had introduced. Oh, it's. I can use this. That's fine. I can just use this for the rest of it if you want me to.
Hello.
Yes. How do we take this off of me? I don't know. I don't want to break this. Do you know how to get this off? Oh, wait. I pinched it. I did it. Okay. Yay, me. So cultural humility is this concept of what is going on inside of us and between us and others. So it's an intrapersonal, you know, the stuff inside of us, and then interpersonal, us and other folks. And I think it's really important to think about that because, you know, some of what I've talked about today is you thinking through your own family history, your own immigration story here. That's the stuff that's inside of you. But then thinking about how you interact with others, generally speaking, what has been your occupation for all these years? What have, you know, if you were a stay-at-home parent, how did that shape your reality and how you interact with others? And remembering that really all work is cross-cultural. Even if somebody is our neighbor, their family rules may be completely different from ours. They might have a like no screen time after 7 p.m. We eat our meals together. There's no TV. You know, the culture shifts just family to family can be very significant. So if you can think about that when you think about cross-cultural, I think it's a lot easier to think about how, you know, for an Afghan family or a family that's being resettled here from Syria, it might feel like there's a big chasm, but there could be a lot of ways you're similar. And, you know, recognizing those dissimilar ways and doing what we can to bridge those gaps is important. So the activity I want to do with you is about acronyms, because I love a good acronym. It's good. It's fun. I always remember acronyms. It's like one of those, how my brain works. And so one of those things that I dangerously do sometimes is that I think if my brain works this way, so does yours. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but acronyms I think are usually a pretty safe bet because it mnemonically connects something, you know, you connect something in your mind between letters and, you know, it's whatever, how memory works. So this one that's the Borkan came up with, who is a medical researcher, was talking about humble as a way to remember humility. So the H was being humble about the assumptions you make from seeing the world from this family's point of view for all of you, understanding how your own background can impact how you interact with others, motivating yourself to learn more, right? Like going, reading things online, going to a restaurant, engaging in, right? If you were going to resettle a Bhutanese family, maybe going to some of the stores that they've set up along Route 51 or, right? Like kind of interacting in some new ways. The B, beginning to incorporate that knowledge into your clinical practice or your work with that family. You know, sustaining yourself to lifelong learning, because one thing that we sort of failed at in social work early on was, like, we talked about cultural competence. Like, we've got this figured out, it's all solved. But the reality is that we're always, things are always changing. And you have to be ready to constantly reflect and shift and change yourself. So recognizing that we're always learning, me, Dr. McClintock, all of us, we're always learning. And then emphasizing respect. Because if you're always showing respect to others, they'll get that. They will sense that from your nonverbal cues. And they will feel more connected to you when they sense that desire to respect them. So part of what the activity is that I wanted to do is making our own acronyms. Because I feel like, are you going to remember humble? Maybe. But you remember your own name a lot better. Or some like role for yourself, like dad or grandpa or, you know, mom, or what's a word that's important to you? So, you know, when I was thinking about an activity to connect on humble, I was thinking about, well, what defines me? And I think Azadeh has always been a part. I always go by Ozzy, but Azadeh means freedom. And it's always been a part of sort of my like call to career or living, or what I've done with my life has been connecting and trying to better the lives of others. So, you know, as I thought about this activity, I was like, well, let's, you know, we're going to use a paper and a pencil here. You're all going to brainstorm for a moment. What's, you know, a name you call yourself or a word or something that has a lot of meaning to you? When you think of you, you always think of this word. You know, is it your first name? Is it your middle name? Is it a nickname you have? Is it a name that your grandkids call you? What is that name? And then thinking about, you know, what I want us to take a moment to do is to think about what each of those letters could stand for. So I did mine up here, my Azadeh one, which was the Z. I was really like, well, all right, we're going to have to sit for a moment and think of something other than zoology. I don't know. but I came up with zealous. Zealous is good, right? That's a fun word. So for my acronym, I thought about my role as a professor, as advisor to students, because a lot of what I do is advise students on career decisions, as well as course decisions, as well as thinking about like what, you know, inside of their career, what are the populations they want to work with? How do they want to make meaning out of their life as a future social worker? So I thought about my acronym in this way. So for all of you, maybe it's thinking about your acronym and working with a family or working with others, maybe connecting with others, being in service to others. I think as a Unitarian, as somebody who went through the Albert Schweitzer Fellowship, a lot of that work I did was about thinking about myself as somebody who serves others. And I think, you know, for individuals who are religious, service is a huge part of what they do in, you know, come to church on Sundays, but all the stuff you're doing outside of church is that service piece. And so maybe thinking about how we serve others in our acronym. So mine was ask others if there are unique personal or cultural considerations that we should review when talking about their degree plan. Zealously engage and support the student so that as they engage in their coursework, some students need me to pull at them more. You know, some of them are really, they're the first one in their family going to college. They don't know what to expect. They don't know that they can access me the way they can access me. So some of my job is to kind of reach out at them and say, yeah, you can talk to me. Like we can email all the time. You can call me at the office. You can stop by my office hours. You know, these are things that you can do to get what you need. Affirming the student's choices, giving them information so that they can make the best decisions, because I don't know what's best for them. I know what I think is best for them, but really they know what's best for them. So if I give them all the facts, then they can make an informed decision, right? And I'm not forcing their decision the way I think they should do it. Because that's a hard part of being an advisor, I think, is really not pushing your own wishes upon others. And I think that that could be true too for you as you serve a family, is thinking about giving them all the information, but not pushing them in what you think is best, because then you're responsible for that. Whereas if they make the decision themselves, they've made the decision. It's a really core part of social work relationships, is that giving people information and letting them choose for themselves without us kind of shoving things in the direction we think is best. Dedicating time during my office hours to reach out to students who I haven't heard from, right? Because sometimes I've just left the students be who I'm not hearing from. I'm not necessarily reaching out, but I think it's really important to do that. If I haven't heard from somebody, maybe there's a reason. Helping when help is wanted, and enabling, empowering my students to help themselves in the future. So I don't expect for you to finish this acronym today, but have some of you thought about the words you want to use for your acronym? Do we have ideas? Do we want to share any ideas? I can bring the microphone to you. What are we thinking about? What are some things, what are we thinking about with cultural humility? What are questions you have about cultural humility? We have two microphones. Guys, so many resources. It's good.
I think of the word kind.
Kind?
K-I-N-D.
Okay. As like something very deeply connected to who you are too. Like that's, yeah. Yeah, you want to be kind to others. I like that. That'd be good. That's a good for an acronym. There's a lot of good K words. All right. How about others of you? Does anybody connect theirs to an identity? A nickname that they like? Hmm? Yeah.
My grandchildren call me Abba.
Abba, okay.
And they call Barbara Bubba. Abba and Bubba.
Great.
And so Barbara said, isn't that not typical of my entire married life? You get to be God and I'm a Southern redneck.
Well,
but I chose Abba.
Okay. And so how do you spell Abba?
A-B-B-A.
Okay. All right. I like that. I think there's a lot of good things you could come up with that. A lot of be this, be that. Okay, good. Very personalized. I like it a lot. You'll remember it too, as you come up with something that's will connect cultural humility for you.
I wanted to say that I am going to start singing Dancing Queen now every time I see you, Hetz, because that is also ABBA.
Yes.
And so I will think of you in a whole new way. I also identify with my name because it's something that's unique that most people don't have. And we also have another one I thought about using. We call ourselves Team Taco, T-O-C-K-E-A-U-X, because it brings together our two last names. So I thought about taco, the X would also be a very tricky.
You'd figure it out, I think. You get a good one. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's gotta be something like that for you to remember it, you know? It's gotta be something you deeply connect with, either through identity, kind, that nick, you know, that name you're called lovingly. It has to be something for you to imbibe this and have it really be something you come back to where you're like, am I doing all those things? Here I am with this family. I'm in my car. I'm about to go in there to talk to them about enrolling the kids in school. It might just be something that you have written out that you just reflect on in the car for a minute before you go in. You know, there are different ways you can use an acronym like this as you're trying to practice something new for yourself. I kind of like to think of it as like a new diet. You know, when you have that new diet, you're like, oh man, can I eat that food? You know, and you go back to your thing, or you're like on your app, or you have a little list for yourself. That's what this acronym could be. It's like your diet for cultural humility. And you're just going to think through what it is that you need to do. Anybody else? Yeah, over here.
So my name is really easy for an acronym. It's Amy. So mm-hmm. only three things I would have to come up with. But I started thinking about it, and you mentioned the meaning of your name, and the meaning of my name is friend. And so I think that is maybe a good way to approach it, because I think there's a tendency when we want to help someone, we treat them like children. Yes. And if we reframe it as a friend, maybe that's a good way to come at it.
I think it also brings you to a more peer-like relationship, right? If you're a friend.
Because you're not going to, you know, you think about your relationships with your friends, you know, advice you would give or the way you would advise them is different than as you would as a parent.
I think that's great. And I think too, you bring up a great point about that parenting piece. I think that can happen a lot in relationships where you're helping somebody else. It becomes this like parentification of your status. Like, I'm here to protect you and help you and guide you, right? Which is a very like, that is part of what you're meant to do. But it also is that kind of that those boundaries, right? As you're talking about it, where you've got to let folks make their own decisions. And if you do too much parenting, they could become resentful of that. It could lead to problems in the relationship. And so it's a very, I guess this cultural humility stuff should make you start to think about some of those fine lines you're going to walk that I don't think everybody thinks through as they kind of approach a new relationship like this. And there's a lot of nuance there in terms of the places where you'll step, and especially as they first arrive. When they first arrive, they will need more from you than they will, you know, a few weeks later. And as they even get to know more families who are, you know, from wherever they're from, as they kind of get connected to those peer groups or other things that are happening, you know, their dependence and reliance on you may be different. And then there are some families who become really heavily reliant, and it can become difficult. We've talked about some of that in JFCS, where families want to, you know, some families who got kind of used to being driven everywhere still want to be driven everywhere. And there are some folks who are like, well, I have the time to do it. Shouldn't I do it? I mean, are you always going to be there to drive them? I mean, the whole big part of social work is helping people help themselves. So it's giving people resources to do for themselves so that they're not reliant on you. But I think, again, it's such a balance at first, because they will need a ride from you at first. That's going to happen. So you have to kind of think about how you'll shift that resource to independence. And that'll be conversations that probably your group has to have as you move on with that.
I was thinking about friend, the word friend.
Yeah.
And I would think that if I had the whole world and all of its wonders and I had no friends, I would not be happy.
Yeah.
So I think the more friends I have, the happier I am. Yeah. And my friends are different from me. Mm-hmm. And that makes it even better.
Yeah. Very good. I love that. I think it's those growth things, right? Makes you grow. And that's what we all want to be doing as humans, is growing. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a tension that gets set up between this notion of I'm proud to be an American and respect for other cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, we want to be part of something larger than ourselves. And so the natural place to go is our countrymen, country persons.
Yeah.
But I think this whole idea of cultural humility is asking us to go way beyond that. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably is not a natural thing for us to do. I think we have to work at it and stretch a little bit. So
I think there's a lot of stretching all of us have to do. I think that's very true. And I think part of that stretch is knowing ourselves better. I think sometimes we think we know ourselves, and then we're challenged with something new when we realize there are parts of ourselves that we haven't been deeply in touch with for a while. And there may be some barriers as to why that is. A cut off of a relationship emotionally with a family member, a cut off with our own culture, where we feel disconnected from our Slovenian culture, our Germanic culture, something like that, right? And here we are trying to engage somebody new in their culture, and we haven't even touched our own. And a little resentment can build somewhere inside of here. So that's why it's so important to have that connection to ourselves really strong now before this family arrives, you know, thinking through your acronym. Yeah.
I thought I'd comment on a situation that I found really awkward.
Yeah.
8 years ago, I wasn't living here. A friend of mine moved. She had a cleaning lady. I'd never had a cleaning lady. What a treat. So she said, why don't you take up the space? Because she needs the job. I said, well, as I said, I've never had a cleaning lady. I can give this a try. So she said, can I give her your number? I said, sure. So this man calls. And I'm thinking, well, this is a little unusual. I didn't think I was going to have a male cleaner. Sorry, guys, but that works. And then he explained that he wasn't the cleaner, it was his mother. And she didn't speak any English. And he was going to help her. I don't know, I found it really awkward, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, are you both coming? You know, how are we gonna work this out? And he said, well, she doesn't speak enough English to come and work. And here was the issue for me. You know, I'm thinking, I mean, trying to be a culturally, you know, competent human being here and to be sensitive of this, but there was a piece of me that wanted to say, well, maybe she could use that space when she's not working to learn English. Mm. That sounds very non-sensitive. It was clear she needed to work.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I found that to be a really awkward situation.
Yeah.
The son said he could come and help her and could translate. I didn't speak her language, obviously. But that didn't work for him either because he really needed to work at another job he had. Sure. So I'm just saying, I've heard other people say similar things, but I just found that to be so awkward. And yet I wanted to help the woman. I really didn't need a cleaning lady, but I thought, well, maybe she could come and I could find some things for her to do because my friend had said she really was eager to work. So I won't go on about this, but you can see how really awkward that is. And I think language is such both a key to economic movement forward, but also the key to one's culture and history and even religion. So I understand that people don't want to lose that as well. So I don't know, comment if you can.
Yeah, it's a great story because you bring up a really important thing about language. And I think, you know, he's talking about his mother. So like we talked about with the Bhutanese folks, so hard to acquire language when you're an older individual and you come here, and how you wanted to really help this, you know, you could see that she needed to work, she needed the money. You wanted to give her an opportunity to earn the money, but it was like, there was something not clicking about the relationship that made it not work. And I think that happens a lot. I think there are a lot of ways in which that can happen where everyone's well-meaning, but it doesn't click in the right way. And I think, again, it's this cultural humility of ourselves that will get us to a better place to be able to make that happen, you know? And I think the language piece, especially for a lot of us who had a parent or a grandparent who struggled with language, it can be, you know, if we watch them struggle and we watch them try to learn language and we see somebody else not doing that or not appearing to do that, that can be hard because you think, well, my parent or grandparent struggled to do that. Why isn't this person? And I think we have to be honest with ourselves. If we're not honest with ourselves about those experiences, we won't be able to help other people. So I think it's a great story. Thank you for sharing it. I think it's, you know, think through all those experiences, the stuff that's yucky, that's, you know, bleh. You got to think through that too. It can't just be the roses and I had this wonderful, like, that's not going to make us grow. We got to get through the, you know, the muck, the dirt. Is it time's up? Did you have one question? Yeah.
Situation from time to time where it's just like an introduction type of, like, I don't know the folks and I'm not going to be a part of their life. But there are some instances too where you almost have to figure out if the intention of that family is for that woman to have the language, mm-hmm. because there have been situations where still their culture says she's not to speak to in that.
Sure, what are the cultural considerations?
Her position is not to have anything to say. And so I have seen the male-female dynamic play out in a situation where I may have thought I might have reacted like, why didn't she? Well, she's not been in a situation to be able to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a great point again. There are so many families where, in, you know, a female should be more deferential to a male, be they Syrian, Afghani, or Christian and very conservative Christian. You know, I think it's important that we recognize that's across a spectrum. I mean, I know some folks, you know, I live in Squirrel Hill. There are some Jewish families in which the wives only talk to other wives. They don't even talk to the other men because they're extremely religious and they don't believe in really consorting or connecting with. I'd say that's just the the spectrum, you know, no matter what your religion is or what your culture is, if you're at the very conservative end of that, that's often what you believe. And so just, again, that part of cultural humility, being aware that that exists in all cultures, right? And recognizing that there are just some ways in which that male, female, you know, matriarchy, patriarchy, all that stuff exists in culture that we have to be respectful of, because we're not going to change other people. They're only going to change themselves if they want to. I know I'm at time. So thank you. If anybody has any other questions for me, I'm up here. Thank you for your time. It was great talking to you.